The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says Biden's regional visit is aimed at getting Arab states to increase their oil production amid the U.S.'s indirect war with Russia. U.S. President Joe Biden reaffirms Washington's military support for Israel, while rights groups and Palestinians slam him for backing an apartheid regime. Also ahead, Iran's president says American officials' frequent regional visits are meant to strengthen Israel's standing, but will fail to bring security for the occupying regime. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story, the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says the U.S. President Joe Biden's West Asia visit is aimed at convincing Arab states to boost their oil production as part of Washington's anti-Russia measures. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said the U.S. administration wants regional Arab states to supply energy to Europe so the West would be able to cut off energy imports from Russia. He said the U.S. means to reduce Russia's oil and gas revenues amid Washington's indirect war against Moscow in Ukraine. Nasrallah also touched upon Hezbollah's recent dispatch of three unarmed drones to a Mediterranean gas field, which is disputed with Israel. He said the operation was aimed at showing that the Karish field is not safe for gas extraction operations.
We want the Israeli to take it down because we want their fighter jets to go up and go and shell rockets. We want them to hit their rockets. We want their rockets to come. We want fire to begin in their region in order for that ship and the engineers on that ship, on all those people on that ship, to know that they are working in a place which is not safe, that there is a true threat in that area.
Nasrallah said the drone operation was just a humble start, adding that a new formula is coming. He said if Lebanon is barred from maritime gas extraction, no one will be allowed to extract gas and oil, and no one will be able to sell gas or oil. The Hezbollah leader emphasized that the movement is able to hamper Israeli efforts to extract oil and gas from the Karish field. Nasrallah warned that Hezbollah is ready to take necessary military measures to protect Lebanon's rights. Nasrallah said Lebanon has a golden opportunity for the next 2 months to secure its maritime rights before the Israeli regime completes work at Karish. He urged the Lebanese officials to use the movement as leverage in their maritime demarcation talks, saying Hezbollah is Lebanon's only strong point. Earlier, we were joined by our Beirut correspondent, Maryam Saleh, who gave us a roundup on the Hezbollah Secretary General's remarks about the Karish oil field disputes with Israel.
Saeed Nasrallah has basically uncovered the plans of the United States. He's uncovered what is happening behind the closed doors, what is happening behind all these talks, and the so back and forth envoys of the U.S. coming to Lebanon for the issue of the so-called demarcation, that the main issue is the fact that the Americans need to provide petrol and gas to the Europeans. And they're striving for the fact that the Israelis provide that gas, provide that petrol, and leave Lebanon in that state of chaos, a state of economic collapse, let it undergo a state where they could not even provide 1 hour of electricity, which the Americans had promised. They had promised 1 year ago that they would give Lebanon an exception from the Caesar Act in order to be given gas from Egypt through Jordan, also through Syria, to have several hours of electricity. That has not been realized because he said that the main project is to put Lebanon in chaos, in addition to prohibiting Lebanon from drilling and extracting its own natural resources. So what we have here is the leader of the resistance basically saying that the resistance is ready to even start a war, not just be ready to deter the Israelis from any sort of invasion, or even to be ready to stop Israeli threats. They are actually ready to even start a war in order for Lebanon to extract its rights.
The U.S. president arrives in Israel for the opening leg of his first visit to West Asia since taking office in 2021. Despite widespread criticism over his trip, Joe Biden has vowed to boost Washington's military support for Tel Aviv.
With this visit, we're strengthening our connections even further. We have reaffirmed the unshakable commitment of the United States to Israel's security, including partnering with Israel on the most cutting-edge defense systems in the world. From here, I'm going straight to a briefing on Israeli missiles and rocket defense capabilities, including the U.S. support for the Iron Dome and Israel's new laser-enabled system called the Iron Beam.
Biden was speaking upon arrival in Tel Aviv. Earlier, Palestinian resistance groups denounced Biden's visit for serving the interests of the Israeli regime. After wrapping up his visit to the occupied territories, Biden will take an unprecedented direct flight from Israel to Saudi Arabia on Friday. He will hold talks with the kingdom's officials and attend a summit of political and economic bloc of six Arab countries called the GCC. U.S. lawmakers, including some Democrats, have already criticized Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia. They have cited the president's promise to put human rights at the heart of his foreign policy. Rights advocates also say Biden's trip could embolden Saudi Arabia to crack down on dissent abroad and restrict civil liberties domestically. Reactions are pouring in over the U.S. president's trip to Israel. A rights group has denounced the visit by putting up banners and billboards in the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem to remind Joe Biden that Israel is an apartheid regime. Israeli rights group B'Tselem says the U.S. government should be held accountable for the Israeli regime's violations and crimes against Palestinians in the occupied territories. It has also called on international bodies to push for an end to the Israeli apartheid system. Biden's visit and his meetings with Israeli officials are taking place at a time when the regime has intensified its deadly crackdown against Palestinians. Meanwhile, the May killing of veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh has clouded Biden's trip. Washington has said there was no evidence that the killing was intentional. That's while a United Nations Rights Office inquiry has concluded that Abu Akleh was in fact murdered by Israeli forces with, quote, several seemingly well-aimed bullets. Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi says his country won't retreat its rightful and reasonable stance in the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. In a cabinet meeting, Raisi urged the U.S. to give up its so-called maximum pressure campaign, which has proved futile. He said Washington could have realized that the Iranian nation doesn't accept the language of force, referring to a U.S. call for Iran to return to the JCPOA. Raisi underlined that it was Washington, not Tehran, that violated the deal.
The Americans have said that Iran should return to the JCPOA. While the Islamic Republic of Iran has never withdrawn from the deal, and it was America who violated the JCPOA. Today, it is a question not only for the Europeans, for allies of the Americans in the negotiations, but also for all the nations around the world, why the United States did not adhere to its commitments in the JCPOA and withdraw from it.
Raisi further said the demands made by Iran's negotiating team are logical within the JCPOA framework. He also commented on U.S. President Joe Biden's trip to West Asia. The president said the repeated visits by American officials are aimed at consolidating Israel's position and pushing some countries to normalize ties with it. Raisi noted, however, that their efforts will in no way bring security for the regime. Raisi further said that Iran is closely monitoring regional developments and will decisively respond to any move against its territorial integrity. Iran's foreign minister has stressed that the Islamic Republic will spare no effort to help bring an end to the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Tehran will avoid any steps that could escalate the conflict further. The top diplomat rejected claims by White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan that Iran is preparing to send several hundred drones to Russia for use in Ukraine. Amir Abdullahian rather took a jab at the West for fueling the flame of war between Kiev and Moscow. He says some Western countries, including the U.S., are manufacturing arms and trying to sell their products. Moscow says the United States and its allies are getting dangerously closer to a military conflict with Russia in Ukraine. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova has accused Washington of provoking an escalation of the crisis by launching a hybrid confrontation with Russia. She's warning that such actions could lead to a direct armed conflict between the nuclear powers. Since the beginning of Russia's military operation in February, the U.S. and its Western allies have been offering military support to Ukraine, and Moscow has repeatedly warned Washington over such military assistance, including the delivery of heavy weaponry, saying that will add fuel to the fire of war. Rights groups are calling for a probe into allegations of war crimes by UK troops in Afghanistan. This after British media investigations found shocking evidence that Britain's special forces executed detainees and murdered unarmed people in cold blood in the war-torn country. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
In a damning report, BBC has revealed that British Special Air Service, SAS, unlawfully killed 54 civilians in the Afghan province of Helmand from 2010 to 2011. The report reveals that senior British officers, including the head of UK Special Forces, were aware of the crimes, but did not report them to military police.
Afghanistan had been the best backyard of the West during past decades. They committed any war crimes they could and violated every rule. Our country was used as the best scene of examining arms and training armies. All NATO forces, including Britain's, were largely involved in scandals. This as they were not being held accountable by any courts. I hope BBC's new report is not a media game only, and it will be followed by a judicial process.
The victims of the 20-year war and Afghan advocates are demanding compensation and accountability for their losses.
There are a lot of helpless women and children in Afghanistan whose lives were devastated as a result of the U.S. and allies' war crimes in our country. Some have lost their fathers and some their breadwinners. Today, they are left on the streets without food or shelter. We urge the UN and those institutions who claim to be the human rights champions to hold the international criminal accountable and help suffering families with compensation.
Previously, dozens of reports were published revealing the scandals and killings by other NATO troops, including American and Australian forces. In total, more than 46,000 Afghan civilians were killed from 2001 to 2021. Afghans are angry over NATO's two decades of destruction in their country. They are also calling for justice for hundreds of civilians who were killed by the U.S.-led coalition's forces during their presence in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The European Commission admits its current strategy to compensate for reduced energy supplies from Russia is inadequate. A surge in oil and gas prices in the EU resulting from sanctions imposed on Moscow are contributing to economic turmoil across the 27-country bloc. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Europe is currently experiencing a heat wave. It means that overall energy consumption is lower than usual. However, winter is fast approaching. The EU has cut energy imports from Russia in retaliation for the war in Ukraine. The bloc has agreed deals with the US, Norway and Qatar to import liquefied natural gas.
Is this enough? No, I don't think it is enough. And this is the reason why on July the 20th we will come with further proposals.
If these proposals fall short, the EU faces a major energy crisis this winter. Economists are already painting a very gloomy picture.
We believe that we are going to face a recession during the winter, given all the headwinds we are facing right now, the energy situation, but also the cost of living situation that is having a strong impact on consumption.
Eurozone finance ministers claim all the blame rests with Moscow.
We started our meeting with a discussion on the economic situation, which continues to be challenging due to the impact of Russia's military aggression and all the global developments that arise from that.
Analysts say EU leaders are hurting their own citizens by placing enormous sanctions on Moscow. At the same time, Russia's economy seems to be performing well. Aside from soaring energy and food prices in the EU, there is worrying volatility in financial markets. The European Central Bank is raising interest rates. The euro is currently very weak, which has the effect of pushing up inflation even more. Croatia is due to become the 20th member of the Eurozone in January. The EU describes this as an historic step. The question is, will Croatians have much to celebrate by the time they start using the struggling euro? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turning elsewhere, survivors of recent US mass shootings and relatives of people killed in them have asked the lawmakers to ban the sale of the powerful assault weapons used in those massacres. The appeal comes after the release of a video of the mass shooting at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas on May the 24th. The video shows a long delay by Texas police and federal agents before they acted to stop the mass shooting. The video has infuriated the parents of kids who were killed in the massacre, which claimed the lives of 19 children and two teachers. In 1994, Congress passed a 10-year ban on assault rifles and certain high-capacity magazines, but lawmakers let it expire in 2004 without renewing the ban, and sales of those weapons have soared since then. Following the Uvalde shooting, President Joe Biden appealed to lawmakers to ban assault rifles or raise the minimum age for buying them from 18 to 21. But Republican lawmakers, who see such a restriction as being against the constitutional right to bear arms, refused to go along with his proposal.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
U.S. lawmakers will rubber stamp a bill authorizing tens of billions more to the Defense Department that it didn't even ask for. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Ben Freeman and Faizeh Fatizadeh writers. This article is published under the heading Congress Showers the Pentagon with Cash While Americans Pinch Pennies. Stay tuned for more. Gas prices are at an all-time high in the U.S. Rent prices have set records for the last 13 months straight. Inflation is increasing so sharply that even the cost of basic utilities has risen by nearly 30% in the last 12 months in the U.S. There are growing fears that the U.S. economy is poised to fall into recession. What is Congress doing as a growing chorus of Americans think these and other economic issues are the most important problems facing the U.S. today? They're planning to give military contractors the biggest payday they have ever seen. This week, at a time when Americans are fighting to keep roofs over their heads and feed their families, Congress's plan is to authorize a record-setting $838.8 billion in spending, not to the American people, but to the Pentagon. As happens nearly every year, more than half of this sum will likely go to Pentagon contractors, whose CEOs make tens of millions of dollars while telling their shareholders that war and rising global tensions are good for business. Yet Congress is on track to give the Pentagon $37 billion more than the military even asked for. Instead of funding projects across the country, such as the littoral combat ship known in U.S. Navy circles as the Little Crappy Ship that reportedly can travel half its maximum speed without cracking its hull, Congress could use this money to pay for a variety of things Americans desperately need right now, like school lunches, affordable housing, and utility assistance programs. Even just lowering taxes by $37 billion or giving this money directly to the American people could put more than $100 in the pocket of every single American at a time when they desperately need it. Not only would spending in such ways benefit the individuals and communities that receive them, it would also help revitalize the U.S. economy and make it more equitable to boot. As has been well documented, defense spending is one of the least economically productive ways the government can spend its money. Spending on education, healthcare, and lowering the taxes, for example, have all been shown to create more and higher-paying jobs. In addition to the economic cost of funneling ever more money into the Pentagon, contractors that win the lion's share of the Pentagon pie have left less and less money for the actual members of the U.S. military. U.S. troops and their families are now facing the same problems of the affordable housing and inflation that plague the rest of the U.S., all while doing their part to defend the country. Teva Jebreler, commentator, documented in Responsible Statecraft last month, increases in rents and inflation have forced many military families in the U.S. to move further and further away from bases and in some cases to live paycheck to paycheck. With military families and other hardworking Americans struggling to make ends meet, why is Congress poised to give government contractors the biggest taxpayer-funded payday they've ever received? In short, Pentagon contractors invest heavily in efforts to get more taxpayer money. They have spread their influence and money around to lobbyists, PR firms, and think tanks to ensure that a rising defense budget lifts all boats inside the Beltway. The defense sector is also one of the top spenders on campaign contributions to members of Congress, particularly to those lawmakers with the greatest sway over the defense budget. In fact, members of the House Armed Services Committee, who last month approved the defense bill the House will vote, have already received more than $3.25 million in campaign contributions from defense contractors in just the current election cycle, according to campaign finance data compiled by Open Secrets. Pentagon contractors also spend more than $100 million on lobbying every year and currently have 652 lobbyists working for them, more than double the 307 lobbyists working for labor groups, for example. That comes to one lobbyist for every elected representative and senator, with more than 100 lobbyists to spare. More than two-thirds of these lobbyists are actually former government employees, including high-ranking congressional staff like Speaker Nancy Pelosi's former chief of staff, who went on to become a lobbyist for BAE Systems. Pentagon contractors also seek out former members of Congress themselves, for example, 5 weeks after Howard McKinn, who chaired the House Armed Services Committee until his retirement from Congress in early 2015, he began representing a defense contractor that employed his services as a principal in the newly formed McKinn Group. Last but certainly not least, defense contractors give tens of millions of dollars to the U.S. top think tanks every year. Scholars at these same think tanks with defense industry ties often write articles and appear in the media promoting ever higher levels of defense spending. In short, this is the military-industrial complex, and it is working overtime to raise the Pentagon budget at taxpayers' expense. Worse yet, Congress is adding tens of billions of dollars that the military didn't even ask for, on top of what was already a record-setting budget request that is more than the defense budgets of the next nine highest-spending countries combined. While much of Washington is on the racket and will also profit from this wasteful government spending, it's Americans struggling to keep the lights on who will pay the price.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have the honor of being joined by Sister Salma Khalfan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. So on the last episode of Muslim Lady, we were talking about the freedom which Islam has drawn for women and how it roughly looks like. And freedom is only helpful and beneficial if it allows us the necessary arena and ground to grow and does not harm the growth of the individual and the collective. Right? We really need to understand this with every cell of our being, every time we want to fight for someone's freedom, anyone's freedom, and to understand that, okay, how much is this freedom helping this person to grow? And with that said, with that in mind, Islam, as you've explained, Sister Salma, has allowed a great degree of freedom for women in any way that serves her growth and the growth of the society and allows her to be a productive and contributing member of her community. It's a no-brainer, right? Who's going to argue with that? So more on that note, which other aspects of freedom do you think Islam has allowed for women?
But you know what? The world is moving forward in a way, like women have realized those things. And you know, sometimes I feel that sometimes situation that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala makes a person arise, you know, like just now the times of the pandemic, people were forced to sit at home. Mm-hmm. And women realized the potentials of being teachers, of working at home. Even men were forced to stay at home.
Yeah.
So there's so many things that Allah wants us to understand through the bad times and the good times. This is one way that I've seen that sometimes when you don't realize, you're forced to realize. We want to choose it out of our own free will. May that the day doesn't come that we have to force ourselves, that we are told, no, you don't have to, like Imam Ali alayhi salam says, do not tolerate that women do things beyond their abilities, because this is more suitable for their status. It calms their hearts and preserves their beauties. Surely women are like fragrant flowers and not warriors.
Mm.
So we know when a woman makes the wrong decision, she's forced to by her husband. Like it's an amr that Imam Ali says, do not tolerate those women.
Oh, that the society pushes her towards.
In Islam, it's like that because Islam wants to bring a stop when something wrong is being done.
Mm.
So this is one of the things that the West don't realize this, you know. They feel that, no, freedom means going out of your limits also for the freedom. There should be rules everywhere. So Islam is like a body which has rules and regulations that are for our betterment and our progress and our perfection in the end.
It's been proven through history that whichever government or system had the most intricate rules and regulations, whose population abided by the most was most successful in running that establishment. It's been proven time and time again that when a governing system puts more attention, more consideration, more assessment into organizing that system of regulation for its people, it means that, well, it kind of knows what it's doing. Yeah. And the more the people abide by it, the more things run smoothly and people can coexist better.
Yeah.
And their country or kingdom or government or whatever flourishes and That's thrives. Right. I just don't know why we haven't been able to grasp that in regard with religion.
Because you know what? The faith, first of all, has to be worked upon. The faith should be so strong that there is someone who is there, who is the manager of all the affairs, inner and outer. When that is strong, and you see many people practicing this kind, you know, of things, those people who have realized they've worked on their faiths, they have so much faith in regard to Allah. And if they have the right kind of faith, they are so moderate in everything. You see they're working, yet they're so successful, they're following the laws of Islam. And you see Allah wanting to lay an example that they should work out there to show that this is the real freedom. Look, this moderation.
It can be done.
It can be done. Mm. It doesn't mean that this person is just confined in the house because she's practicing the Islamic laws. This person is practicing the Islamic laws and she's also working. A woman, as far as a woman is concerned. Because a woman has a very crucial role in the society. She rocks the cradle with one hand, like Imam Khomeini says, and the world with another. Another freedom that we would like to talk about is the freedom of ownership.
Very interesting.
It's very interesting because in the Arab Jahiliya, when you go and see before the advent of the Holy Prophet, women were not given rights of property. They were used as slaves.
They were used as workers.
They were the property. It's very sad, isn't it? A woman, like, look at ourselves. We have feelings, we have emotions, we have ambitions, we want this and that, and we want to be known, and we want, you know, we want so many good things.
Acknowledged,
yes,
and appreciated.
We want good knowledge, appreciation, everything. But that, everyone has, Allah has given them, but they're deprived. If they don't have even that right of ownership, then like it's really unjust, I feel.
It really
but
is.
Islam has said, no, that's your property. Mm-hmm. And so much property, for example, starting with the right of, you know, like inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
She has the right to inherit. First of all, she's allowed to work also with consent of her husband. Mostly husbands, even if they see that everything is rationally going on, they allow their wives to work. Of course, there are some people who see that there is more harm than good. Then they deprive the wife that they're doing the right thing. Like your Imam Ali says,
her.
Don't let them work, right? When they're making the wrong decisions. So that when she gets her income, that is hers. And you know, she can use it without her husband's permission also, because it's her property, right? She can give out sadaqah through that. She can buy. She can do good things. Of course, the good things that she wants to do. When you have your own pocket money, what's stopping you? I feel, of course, you don't have to, you know, go and be extravagant on that. And that is like according to our intellectual state. We don't want to do that, right? So she has that freedom to earn and to keep her property and to grow her wealth and to inherit and to also, you know, like give out charity in whatever way she wants and grow her wealth. It respects a woman and man in this, you know, both of them. Mm-hmm. They have the right to earn and to also grow their wealth.
It's a very important aspect too, especially when you think about 1400 years ago, when all of Europe was in the Dark Ages. Even before that, countries in Asia, women were inherited instead of receiving inheritance. Women were treated as property instead of having ownership over their own property. And then Islam comes around and it's like, no, you all have to stop doing this. Yes. This is what's going to happen from now on, because it didn't recognize, it reminded people.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, that it's women. Zikr, exactly. Right? That women are their own existence.
And they're Allah's amanat, just like men, right?
Exactly.
They have the, they are allotted the same reward. Mm. And they can also become sadiqeen and sabireen and khaniteen and, you know, beautiful things.
Yeah, exactly.
And earn that position of heaven, which is, you know, jannati, the exclusive jannah.
Exactly.
So a woman, if she is given all these goodnesses, then of course she's not left out, you know, not, you know, just confining her to a place that, or a situation that she can't come out. In Quran also, if you go and see, there's an ayat that says that to men is allotted what they earn and to women is allotted what they earn. So, you know, Quran clarifies that if you earn something, that is your allotment. And in fact, such a great allotment it is that, of course, in some areas, although she's given less, but it compensates for example, in this way that, you know, she's given less inheritance, she's given that wage, that husband's earning that has to be used on her, the alimony. So she has to be under him and she has to enjoy all those things that her husband spends for her. So it doesn't mean that, you know, she's given little. It's compensated for. Islam sees both sides.
Mm-hmm.
If she works, it's her own money. But of course, a very thoughtful woman would also contribute.
Of course.
We have so many examples in Islam, like Hazrat Khadija, salamullahi alayha. She was wealthy, but she contributed her wealth for the betterment of Islam, for the betterment of her family, and, you know, to raise the orphanages.
Mm-hmm.
She spent her wealth in this way.
Right.
She has to also give this responsibility to herself that I have to use it for others as well. This is not my, it's an amanat in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
Allah gave me this to test me. Right?
Exactly.
So,
and just that, I guess that comes to show that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, by giving a woman financial and economic autonomy, he is recognizing her ability to manage all these
affairs.
That's
a beautiful point, to manage, how much she can manage.
Exactly.
You know, and that's and women could manage to be a businesswoman, to do trading, with
exactly.
Allah.
And like you said, Sister Sama, alhamdulillah, owed to technology today, so much of that is now possible from the comfort and security of her own home. She can just sit around in front of a laptop. All she needs is stable Wi-Fi, and the world is at her fingertips. We blame technology and social media so much, but it also comes with these pros and blessings.
That's right. Absolutely. It's like the free will that you have. You choose what's right and wrong. That's upon you. You see women complaining that they have so much work to do at home. You know, household chores and everything.
Yeah, it never finishes.
Yeah, it never finishes because they're not happy with that.
Mm.
They're not counting it as like an ibadat, or
they're
not counting it as something that gives them satisfaction. They think the material aspect of it gives them more.
Exactly.
The women who are outside,
Yes. They don't feel appreciated, right?
Yeah.
But if they realize that a single cup a single glass of water that she moves from this counter to the other counter in her home is appreciated, is acknowledged, is rewarded by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes, by Allah. You see, she wants people to appreciate
it. Yeah, exactly.
So if she just improves her faith and feels though Allah is appreciating it, it would be enough for her. And that would be her goal and her aim. And then it would flow.
We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
I also know of women who are so happy that they're women.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's so sad. Yeah, when a woman feels that, why is a man doing all this work? This kind of man's world thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's sad. Like, if you see children around you, they will be naturally attracted to the way they are. Like, if it's a girl, she will feel like, you know.
She wants to mother that
doll. Yeah, or to play role playing like a mother and a child, carry a doll or something like that, to nurture something, to play creative. But a boy, he was rough. He wants to play more and, you know, throw more and just create a mess and things
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. And that's just a different way based on their biology of how they express their creativity.
Yeah, absolutely. She can raise a very powerful leader.
Exactly.
With her good emotions, with her care, with her attention, with her all these good qualities and emotions.
And both are definitely strengths. I don't understand why society is like condemning it. Like, oh no, it's too girly for you to be playing with dolls. You know, why don't you go punch someone's nose? Why do you make it out to be such a bad thing if she's compassionate and caring?
Because materialists, they want to take us away from our fitrat as much as possible.
True.
They want to just drive you to the material aspects, power, wealth, takasur, you know, tafakhur, all these kind of things that is mentioned in the Quran.
And that's why the world is so chaotic now, isn't it?
It's absolutely very chaotic and very sad. And people don't realize that also. You know, they themselves who makes those kind of rules are like
and
left.
Then it backfires
exactly,
on them.
Exactly, backfires them. Wa makaru, wa makarullah, wallahu khairul makiri. He uses their own tricks to backfire
exactly.
them, you know. Allah, he knows all the planning beautifully. So, yeah, this is as far as the right of working is concerned, the right of ownership and property is concerned. Mm-hmm. And a woman can also enjoy that. And alhamdulillah, she does enjoy. We see that she's enjoying it, and, you know, and she's making use of it, good use of it. And sometimes, unfortunately, a woman makes bad use of also her property, which is, of course, because of lack of proper knowledge and guidance.
Thank you so very much, Sister Salma, and thank you to our listeners for being with us on this episode of Muslim Lady. Until another greeting, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Small teams of U.S. Special Operations Forces are involved in a low-profile proxy war program on a far greater scale than previously known, according to exclusive documents and interviews with more than a dozen current and former government officials. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Nick Turris and Alice Sperry, authors. This article is published under the heading How the Pentagon Uses a Secretive Program to Wage Proxy Wars. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Small teams of U.S. Special Operations Forces are involved in a low-profile proxy war program on a far greater scale than previously known, according to exclusive documents and interviews with more than a dozen current and former government officials. While The Intercept and other outlets have previously reported on the Pentagon's use of the secretive 127E authority in multiple African countries, a new document obtained through the Freedom of Information Act offers the first official confirmation that at least 14 127E programs were also active in the West Asia and Asia-Pacific regions as recently as 2020. In total, between 2017 and 2020, U.S. commandos conducted at least 23 separate 127E programs across the world. Separately, Joseph Votel, a retired four-star Army general who headed both the Special Operations Command and Central Command, which oversees U.S. military efforts in the West Asia region, confirmed the existence of previously unrevealed 127E counterterrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. Another former senior defense official who requested anonymity to discuss a classified program confirmed that an earlier version of the 127E program had also been in place in Iraq. A 127E program in Tunisia, codenamed Obsidian Tower, which has never been acknowledged by the Pentagon or previously identified as a use of 127E authority, resulted in combat by U.S. forces alongside local surrogates in 2017, according to another set of documents obtained by The Intercept. A third document, a secret memo that was redacted and declassified for release to The Intercept, sheds light on hallmarks of the program, including use of authority to provide access to areas of the world otherwise inaccessible even to the most elite U.S. troops. The documents and interviews provide the most detailed picture yet of an obscure funding authority that allows American commandos to conduct counterterrorism operations by with and through foreign and irregular partner forces around the world. Basic information about these missions, where they are conducted, their frequency and targets, and the foreign forces the U.S. relies on to carry them out, are unknown even to most members of relevant congressional committees and key State Department personnel. Through 127E, the U.S. arms, trains, and provides intelligence to foreign forces. But unlike traditional foreign assistance programs, which are primarily intended to build local capacity, 127E partners are then dispatched on U.S.-directed missions, targeting U.S. enemies to achieve U.S. aims. The foreign participants in a 127 ECHO program are filling gaps that we don't have enough Americans to fill. A former senior defense official involved with the program told The Intercept, adding, if someone were to call a 27 ECHO program, a proxy operation, it would be hard to argue with them. Retired generals with intimate knowledge of the 127E program, known in military parlance as 127 ECHO, say that it is extremely effective in targeting militant groups while reducing risk to U.S. forces. But experts told The Intercept that use of the little-known authority raises grave accountability and oversight concerns and potentially violates the U.S. Constitution. One of the documents obtained by The Intercept puts the cost of 127E operations between 2017 and 2020 at $310 million, a fraction of U.S. military spending over that time period, but a significant increase from $25 million budget allocated to the program when it was first authorized under a different name in 2005. Critics contend that due to a lack of oversight, 127E programs risk involving the United States in human rights abuses and entangling the U.S. in foreign conflicts, unbeknownst to Congress and the American people. Former commanders say the 127E authority is crucial to combating terrorism. For more than a year, the White House has failed to provide The Intercept with substantive comment about operations by U.S. commandos outside conventional war zones, and specifically failed to address the use of 127E programs. Critics of 127E warn that in addition to the risk of unanticipated military escalation and the potential cost of engaging in up to a dozen conflicts around the world, some operations may amount to an unlawful use of force. Because most members of Congress, including those directly responsible for overseeing foreign affairs, have no input and little visibility into where and how the programs are run. 127E-related hostilities can lack the congressional authorization required by the U.S. Constitution, argued Catherine Ebright, counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice. There is reason to suspect the Department of Defense has used 127E partners to engage in combat beyond the scope of any authorization for the use of military force or permissible self-defense, Ebright told Intercept, noting substantial confusion at the Pentagon and in Congress over a stipulation that 127E programs support only authorized ongoing military operations. Adding, that kind of unauthorized use of force, even through partners rather than U.S. soldiers themselves, would contravene constitutional principles. The origins of the 127E program can be traced back to the earliest days of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, as commandos and CIA personnel sought to support the Afghan Northern Alliance in its fight against the militants. Army Special Operations Command soon realized that it lacked the authority to provide direct payments to its new proxies and was forced to rely on CIA funding. This prompted a broader push by SOCOM to secure the ability to support foreign forces in so-called missions, a military corollary to the CIA's use of militia surrogates. First known to Section 1208, the authority was also deployed in the early years of the Iraq invasion. According to a former senior defense official, it was ultimately enshrined in U.S. law under USC Title 10, 127E. 127E is one of the several virtually unknown authorities granted to the Defense Department by Congress over the last two decades that allow U.S. commandos to conduct operations on the fringes of war and with minimal outside oversight. With 127 e-focuses on counterterrorism, other authorities allow elite forces, Navy SEALs, Army Green Berets, and Marine Raiders among them, to conduct clandestine intelligence and counterintelligence operations or assist foreign forces in irregular warfare, primarily in the context of so-called great power competition. In April, top special operations officials unveiled a new vision and a strategy framework that appears to endorse continued reliance on the 127E concept by leveraging burden-sharing partnerships to achieve objective within an acceptable level of risk. General Richard D. Clark, the current Special Operations Commander, testified before Congress in 2019 that 127E programs directly resulted in the capture or killing of thousands of terrorists, disrupted terrorist networks and activists, and denied terrorists operating space across a wide range of operating environments at a fraction of the cost of other programs. Clark's claims cannot be verified. A SOCOM spokesperson told The Intercept that the command does not have figures on those captured or killed during 127E missions. It is also not known how many foreign forces and civilians have been killed in these operations. But a former defense official confirmed to The Intercept that there have been U.S. casualties, even as U.S. troops are traditionally expected to stay behind last cover and concealment during a foreign partner's operations. The documents obtained by The Intercept tout the importance of the authority, particularly in providing U.S. special operators a way into difficult-to-access areas. According to a memo, 127E program provided the only human physical access to areas with local partners focused on finding, fixing, and finishing enemy forces. Another 127E program targeting Al-Qaeda and its affiliates similarly allowed commandos to project combat power into previously inaccessible VEO or violent extremist organization safe havens.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.